Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Cole Schaefer. And what I love about Cole is how he is willing to just put his soul onto the page of writing and put his soul into a conversation like he did today. He is willing to be open, he is willing to be raw, and he is willing to tell his truth to the best of his abilities to his soul. And that is something that's rare, especially in a world of Instagram where everyone's trying to put their best face forward and everyone's trying to appear a certain way. Cole is someone who is willing to pull back the curtain, and that is really powerful. So with all that being said, I had an incredible conversation with Cole Schaefer, who is an incredible writer. You guys should check out honeycopy.com for more from Cole if you want it. And I had a great time. If you enjoyed this episode, let me know on Twitter. At Hey Danny Miranda is the best place to find me and to give me feedback for this conversation. All right, let's get right to it, guys.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
So, why don't we start things off by you selling to me on why I should live in Nashville?
Okay, absolutely. That works great. Okay, so I don't know how salesy you're wanting me to get here. Generally, my sales process is pretty chill. I definitely don't want to ever sell someone something they don't want. But if I were really trying to sell you, I'd first and foremost ask you what you don't like about where you live right now, to which you would answer.
Well, I live in New York. I love that it's close to family. I love that, you know, it has seasons, but at the same time, I don't like the cold. The cold is, it just gets me. At one point, I get excited by the cold, but another, it's hard, man. It's hard to be in that environment all the time.
Right. Well, I think that said, my biggest selling point on Nashville is that it is beautiful and sunny 9 to 10 months out of the year, and probably about 2 months out of the year, you have cold. And the cold isn't even severe. It might be 40 degrees tops. And so I recently moved to Nashville from Chicago, and that was such a beautiful change of pace, because in Chicago, you know, a cold day in the winter might be 10 degrees, right? Whereas in Nashville, a cold day is 35 degrees. And it was funny, once I moved here, some of my friends were like, why are you wearing shorts? It's 40 degrees outside. And they didn't realize, you know, it feels like Florida in Nashville compared to Chicago. So if you hate the cold, I can't think of a better city down south to live in than Nashville if you're trying to escape the cold weather.
You know, I love how methodical you are about how you approach the conversation. And before thinking about trying to sell me on why I should do something, you were first asking questions. And that, to me, speaks to who you are as a marketer and a salesman. So let's dive into your story and who you are. How did you get, were you always someone who was asking questions, was curious, was trying to help other people achieve an end? Or is that something you developed in your more recent life as a copywriter?
Sure. I would say I was always extremely curious about everything. And that's one quality that makes for not only a good copywriter, but a good writer. And that's one correction I'll make here, not really correcting you, but just in general, because a lot of people view me as a copywriter, but I view myself more as a writer. And by day, I work as an advertising writer, and I run a small copywriting shop called Honeycopy. And then when the sun goes down and the wine and the bourbon start flowing, then I'm a poet. So I write poetry and I moonlight as a poet. So anyways, all that said, I think something that makes a really good writer is this ornate curiosity, where you're curious of the world and you're curious of the people who live in the world and their experiences. And you kind of become obsessed with putting those experiences and those feelings and these sort of shared human conditions into words. And that ultimately is what led me to writing, is I just became obsessed with trying to find this shared kind of common ground between people, whether that's heartbreak or whether that's the excitement that comes with buying a new product, whatever that looks like.
So for you, it is, can I get the feelings that are inside of me and bring that feeling to someone else? That's what a good writer does in your perspective, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely approach writing almost strictly from an emotional standpoint. I don't think people are extremely logical. I think we make most of our decisions based off of emotions. So it serves me well when I'm trying to sell something with pretty words, but it obviously serves me well when I'm writing poetry too, just because that is such an emotional vocation.
What are some of the best ways a writer can get that emotion inside of them to someone else?
Honesty. I would say honesty. That's why a lot of the writing you read on the web today is extremely difficult to connect with. I always use LinkedIn. Excuse me, LinkedIn as an example, because LinkedIn has just become this cesspool of quote unquote thought leaders who might not have any sort of experience as a thought leader in whatever fill in the blank industry they put, right? But they are just trying to fulfill this content calendar that they've created for themselves, like a post a day. And it's all very empty messaging. And it just doesn't really resonate with people. And I think when you dig deeper, you realize they're not being honest and they're not being authentic about how they truly feel. And some LinkedIn posts that are super hilarious are these parents making up shit that their kids have said, and then they will write this sort of LinkedIn post around like a business or life career lesson around what their kids said. And you take a step back and you're like, okay, I 100% don't think your child used the word synergy while you two were having ice cream. So yeah, man, I just try to be honest to a fault in a lot of ways. And I'm sure I've shot myself in the foot sometimes, but I feel like people really connect with my writing when I'm just real and unapologetically myself.
How do you balance the idea of, oh, I'm just going to put up a post a day versus the what Stephen Pressfield, who I know you're a fan of, calls the resistance or defeating that and becoming a pro. So how do you balance the idea of like, yes, I have to show up every day with, you know, like I have a schedule of a post a day and not lose yourself in that?
Right. I just want to make sure I'm understanding the question correctly. So you're asking how do you allow resistance to keep you from not doing the work, right? Is that kind of the question, or
more so how do you become a pro? Like how do you show up every day
and without selling out?
Exactly. That's the question.
Okay, cool. Yeah, man. So it's a really fine line to walk. And something I try to keep in mind is frequency is a beautiful thing. As long as what you are frequently putting out into the world is good and valuable, right? Mm-hmm. Frequent plates of horse shit are literally just lots and lots and lots of horse shit, right? It can ruin you as a person or a brand, and people just don't want to read it. So I think you, for yourself, have to create some sort of baseline in there to say, this is the level of quality I want to put out into the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that has to necessarily be 100%, because there's no such thing as perfect, right? A motto I use for myself is make do and then make better. So I try to put out several posts a week and send out several emails a week, but I also remove a little bit of the pressure to make it perfect. I'm shooting for B pluses on a lot of that work because I am putting stuff out at a higher frequency, right? But there have been many times in my life where I look at a piece a year down the road and I have the opportunity to improve upon it. Something I'm dealing with right now is a book cover that I did for my first book of poetry and prose called 1 Minute Please. And at the time, I didn't need a book cover that could be hung in some art museum. I needed a book cover that I could house a book in to prove to myself that I had a book within me, right? Mm. But now, a year later, I'm looking at this book cover and it's for poetry, right? So it's me on the cover and I'm tatted and I have my shirt off and I'm looking at it and I'm like, that feels a little bit pompous and I don't necessarily know if I want that to be the cover on my book for the rest of my life. So at the time I made do and I got a book cover out into the market. And now a year later, after having a little bit different of maybe a worldview, I'm making that book cover better. So that's how I overcome resistance and at the same time don't allow myself to be a sellout.
What changed in the year from you believing that you being the cover of this book is not something you would like to see anymore or have in the future? What changed in your mind, or how did you change as a person to create that shift?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a two-part answer. First and foremost, I realized that I could potentially be a career author rather than just a one-time, you know, a one-hit wonder, if you will. Mm. And I got some really, really great feedback on that book, and it resonated with some people I never thought it would resonate with. And it just made me realize, you know, I want to do one of these a year or one of these every 2 years. And I want this book cover to be my life's work. And I think in a lot of ways, I try to rage against the machine that is the Kardashians. And in a way, I think that that book cover, me being on that cover and being naked and obviously not like fully naked, but it kind of feels like a little bit like soft porn. And it just didn't feel like it aligned anymore with what I was going for. Now, I will say, like, sex and like edginess and being bold is a huge part of my marketing strategy. So there are pictures like that that I use to push the book, but it just didn't seem like it aligned with who I wanted to be on a longer term basis. So that's kind of part one. Part two is I asked a bunch of the readers, you know, what did you like and dislike about the book? And I have a large female audience, and something a few of the women readers said was they loved the book, but it wasn't something they could keep out on their coffee table because they felt a little bit uncomfortable with having a boyfriend or a husband or a significant other occupying their space with them. And then there's this half-naked dude on a book cover. So, yeah, man, it's a two-part answer where on one side, I felt like it no longer aligned with who I am. I think we're constantly morphing, and we shouldn't apologize for who we were yesterday or last year or 10 years ago. And with that, I sort of put my marketing hat on and realized, hey, there's some ways we can improve the product.
Yeah. I love that, man. So how do you pay attention to your audience? Is it like you're just constantly reaching out for feedback, or you're reading their replies? Like how do you go about listening to people who consume your stuff?
Great question. So I heavily build in a feedback loop in all of my work. So 1 Minute Please, every single page within that book, I had published previously on Instagram, just on my story. So readers read every single page before it actually became a book.
Wow.
And it was this really beautiful process where I could see which pieces really resonated with people. And it was also intimate, right? Because it wasn't on the web where other people could read their responses to the work. It was in the inbox. So people were able to respond to a story and say, hey, this really, really resonated with me for this reason. And then they felt comfortable enough to share maybe a story of their own. And so I felt like I had like 3,000 readers reading my book as I was writing it, which was just such a gift. So yeah, I just try to build feedback into my writing process and make it to where it's impossible to not see. Maybe there's feedback that you have to ignore because it isn't the right feedback to make the work better, but I generally try to always like build in that loop.
When you were starting your book, did you plan to make this a book, or was it something that you were just like, oh, here's a bunch of poems and oh my God, this should be a book? How did that come together? Bottom up or top down?
For sure. No, I just one day woke up and was like, I feel like I have some poetry in me. And I started kind of dabbling, writing a little bit of poetry, and thought, man, this feels good. And it feels like it doesn't just feel good. It feels like it might read pretty well too. And I put a few pieces out on Instagram, and I feel like it was just deeper shit than a lot of what people were reading on there. And I got some amazing feedback, and I just said, what the hell? Like, I'm going to write a book. And so I announced it probably by the third or fourth piece I published. I literally laid it all out in a post, and I could send you a link to it. But I will add that to my story every once in a while, just to remind people, like, there was a time when I wasn't a published author, and you have to start somewhere. So I announced it and kind of created that pressure on myself where, all right, like, you just announced to the world that you're going to become a published author. Now you have to live up to it. So it was sort of some forced pressure.
Dude, I absolutely love that and adore that, because when I started this podcast, what I said to people was, I'm going to put out 100 episodes. That's it. Like, and if I didn't live up to that, then it's like, well, people know that I'm a fraud. And when you make that public commitment, it is so valuable, and it allows you the opportunity to know that you have to do the work. There's no excuse. There's nothing in your way. So hats off to you, man. Awesome job.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. When you announce to the world, hey, I want 100, I'm gonna get to 100 podcast episodes, it makes it really, really hard to quit at 50.
Yeah, absolutely. So in doing research for this conversation, I noticed something about you, and that is you always seem, from my perspective, let me know if I'm wrong, that you seem convicted to pursue the path for you, even if it was going to upset others. I listened to a conversation where you talked about you were in construction and you had to go to the advertising agency, and you didn't care about what others thought. Then it was like, you know, there was a guy on LinkedIn and he thought you were doing something wrong, and you didn't care because you knew it was authentic to who you were and what was right to you. So my question to you is, how do you get the conviction to pursue the path that is right for you, even if you know it's going to upset others?
Absolutely. I can give a long answer here or a short answer. If you would like me to tell the advertising story,
I would love to.
That resonates with people. Cool, man. Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories to tell. So right after college, I graduated in 2016 with a degree in marketing, right? And so I did what most college grads do. I went to work for a company. The company I worked for was a super small advertising agency in my hometown of Southern Indiana. And I got about a month into that job, and I just found myself absolutely hating it. And I remember it was like 2 o'clock. It was right after I had a big lunch. I had kind of gained some weight from just eating and sitting at a desk and maybe not keeping up with my workouts. And I felt lethargic. And I even remember the feeling of, it's such a visceral feeling, but when your belly kind of hangs over your belt buckle and it's kind of like pinching the underside of your belly. I was at that point in my life, and I remember just sitting at this desk, staring at this exposed brick wall, just thinking, I feel like I could just bash my head into this thing. You know, I just was so frustrated and felt so stuck there. And so I just stood up from my desk and I walked out. I just left. And I put a pin there and just say, I don't ever think that's a good idea. I'm not saying like be an asshole and walk out on your job by any means. But I left. That's what I needed to do at that time. I got home, I emailed my boss and I said, hey, I'd love to set up a meeting tomorrow. The next day I put in my 2 weeks. She was super, super kind about the whole thing, knew it wasn't a good fit. And she just said, hey, Cole, like, let's not do the whole 2 weeks thing. Like, you're ready to go. I'm cool with you getting out of here. And that was then. We ended on good terms. So then I went to work for a construction company, and I'd get up at 7 a.m. and I'd work from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. every single day. And the reason I took that job is because I could get off work, and then from like 3 until midnight or whatever time, I could just grind and write and reach out to brands and cold email them and get in touch with them and just slowly build up this agency that would essentially become Honeycopy one day. And so I'd wake up and I'd go into these old apartment buildings, and my job was to tear out this nasty, dilapidated carpet in these buildings. And it was messy, messy work. Like, there'd be cat piss on the floor. And one time I saw these used needles on the floor. So I started wearing really heavy leather gloves. But it was also this beautiful experience of kind of like earning your stripes. It's like, okay, cool. Like, you want to be the hard ass that walks out on your boss. Now you're paying for it to pursue your dreams. Well, anyways, all that came to a head one day when my advertising agency, and they didn't realize I worked at this construction company, they needed to do a remodeling on their agency. So somehow fate would have it that they hire this construction company. And a month after I had quit, I walk into this advertising agency. I'm in work boots. I'm in a cutoff. I'm sweating my ass off, and I'm tearing out carpet in this advertising agency. My ex colleagues are like looking at me, and none of them are being rude. I want to say that, like, they're all good people, but there was a look in their eyes like, you know, what the fuck is Cole doing? And I remember just sitting there carrying out these rolls of carpet, just wanting to cry, you know, literally just wanting to cry, because I'm this college grad and I'm pursuing this crazy dream of writing, and it doesn't really feel like I'm getting anywhere as I'm tearing out this carpet in what previously was a really good job. And I had this really enlightening experience in that moment where I realized the pain of tearing out that carpet was not nearly as painful as sitting at that desk doing a job that I hated. And from that point on, that was sort of rock bottom for me, where I realized if I have to tear out carpet for the rest of my life to pursue this career in writing, this vocation in writing, because at the time it wasn't a career, that's what I'm going to do, you know? And so it all just, that's where that conviction began. And I think it just has sort of stuck with me over the years. You know, I just realized how low I had gotten, and while at rock bottom of hell, also realizing, damn, this isn't so bad, because I still get to go home at the end of the day and do what I love, you know?
Was that something that as a child were there examples of that in your childhood, or was it something that you believed you developed later on in life, that conviction?
For sure. I would say as a child, you know, definitely, and maybe not as much as a child, but more in the teenage years, I, in a past life, was obsessed with basketball, wanted to play in the NBA and didn't get there, but ended up playing some college ball in Louisville. And I remember in high school, one sort of regulation to make the team was that you had to run a 6-minute mile. And the first day I ran it, I got it in like 7 minutes and 50 seconds, right? And you run across that line and the coach says 7 minutes and 50 seconds, you realize, I don't know how I'm gonna cut 1 minute and 50 seconds off my time. And like that day, my dad and I went and got a stopwatch, and every morning I'd wake up, get out of bed, and start running around my neighborhood. We had marked off a mile. And you do it, and I did it over and over and over again. And for the first week, I got slower, right? And wow. One day, like, I walked inside and, you know, was in a piss poor mood and was telling my dad, you know, I just can't do it. I can't run a 6-minute mile. And he said something that was so simple, but to me was so impactful. And he said, Cole, the truth is you're just not running hard enough. You know, like, wow. You're just not running hard enough. And at the time, like, you kind of want to hit your dad because you're out of breath and he's telling you you're not running hard enough. And the next day I get out there, it's 5, 6 a.m. before school, and I run, and I just decide I'm going to run to the point where I either fall down or like I'm throwing up or something. I'm just going to hit that point. And I cross a line and it was seven minutes and 30 seconds. So I'd gotten 20 seconds quicker. And I did that again and again. And weeks go by and we have to run this mile. And I run across the finish line at 5 minutes and 42 seconds. Right. And so that was sort of this metaphor for me that I've kind of used throughout life where I don't know how much it has to do with skill. It does have something to do with skill, but it also has a lot to do with refusing to quit and sort of having that doggedness to just say, I'm willing to get myself pretty close to feeling like I'm going to die to reach my dreams. So I think it kind of started there and just kept with me, you know.
That's an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that. It reminds me of something I had Madison Fisher. She's a young rock climber on the podcast, and she talked about the idea of just really giving your effort. So much time in life where we're just letting it go, or we're doing what we think is as best as we can, and then it's not really our hardest effort. And also something that the Navy SEAL said was like, we only use 40% of our total strength or total mind or something like that. But it just goes to show we have so much more left in the tank, and we rarely refuse to actually push ourselves to that place. So I'm curious, as a writer, do you apply that to writing? Do you apply that mentality to other areas of your life? And if so, how do you do that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll give two examples. You know, first I'll start with the gym. Obviously, from my athletic background, that has just been something that sticks with me. And I view exercise and running and lifting as really a great way to physically make space in the mind. You know, I kind of view it as you walk into a home and it's super, super cluttered and dirty. And after you clean out that home, you know, it takes a little bit of energy. It takes some elbow grease. But after you do that, you have this beautiful space and this peace that sort of overcomes you. I think physical activity can be worked in the same way. So generally when I find myself really anxious or unhappy or feeling like I'm spiraling, it normally stems from not hitting it hard enough in the gym. And one example I can give recently is, like, I've always approached my workouts from this three sets of 10, 12, 15 repetitions, right? That's how most people approach lifting. And I approach my deadlifts that way, where I would do, I'd do 135 pounds and I might do three sets of 15. And the other day I got off the treadmill after running 2 or 3 miles and I get to the deadlift bar and I was like, I wonder if I can just get 100 reps on this thing versus trying to do 36 or 45 reps, right? I wonder if I can do that, because I had never tried. And so I started out and I went 20 reps, 18, 16, 14, and went all the way down. And by the end of it, I had done 110 reps. And again, that's not fucking Iron Man or anything, right? There's people who can do 300-400 pound deadlifts, but it was this small feat for me where I showed myself I can do triple the amount of reps than I ever thought I could, just simply because I created the constraint in my head. There's a really interesting story that I heard one time where two men set out at the beginning of the month, and one man says, I need to make enough money to pay my rent this month. And the other man says, I need to make $10,000 this month. And they both end up being right. And I've always wanted to be the man that says, I want to make $10,000 this month. And so I think a lot of the times we meet the goals that we set for ourselves, and we have to really set those higher. So to loop back around in writing, I'm always trying to do that with writing, whether it's I want to read 52 books this year, right? Or I want to put out 3 articles a week. I'd probably still hit the goal if I just said 1 article a week, but I want to be kind of the 3-article guy. And so, yeah, I try to create that space there too.
I think we underestimate so often how much we can actually do and accomplish, and it's just a matter of setting that constraint. So I want to switch gears here and talk about your Instagram aesthetic, because I went through your Instagram and I was like, okay, is this guy a model? Is he you know, what is he doing? Like, this doesn't appear to be a writer. But I think a lot of people would be surprised to be like, oh, this guy's a writer from the way you present yourself on Instagram. And so what goes into your mind when you're creating this aesthetic, this particular aesthetic on Instagram and your entire brand in general?
For sure. So they live in two buckets, obviously. You know, in one bucket, it is – excuse me. Got a frog in my throat.
You're good. No worries.
In one bucket, it's honey copy in that world of advertising, right? And that's sort of the aesthetic I've created on honey copy. But then on Instagram, that's more for when I throw on the poetry hat and I am trying to push more covers of 1 Minute Please. And so as far as the aesthetic goes there, I realized early on in my career that unfortunately the cliche, you know, don't judge a book by its cover is bullshit, right? People love pretty things. They love like pretty aesthetics. And so with Instagram, I've really made an effort to create, go that extra mile with how I present myself there. So everything is in black and white. Everything is grainy. Everything looks like, even though it was taken a day, it feels nostalgic, right? I'm super inspired by writers of the 20s, 30s, and 40s and black and white film and that vibe. So I've really made an effort to create that feel when you get on Instagram. And something that I think is important too for creatives to keep in mind is you have to play the game. And so going back to kind of the shirtless picture on the cover, right? Even though I don't want my life's work to necessarily be me shirtless on a cover, I'm also okay with saying, hey, I'm going to take a picture that's a little bit edgier, maybe a little bit risque to get a female reader to read the actual article or the actual post or the actual write-up. Because if I can get her or him or whoever to read that post, I have an opportunity to heavily impact their day, which could potentially heavily impact their life. So no, I don't think I'm changing people's lives by having a pretty Instagram, but I think I can have a massive impact on someone's life if they dig deeper into my Instagram and read the super heartfelt pieces that I'm writing as I post those pictures.
Have you always been someone who has prioritized aesthetic? Because personally, I don't view myself as good at design, but I know it's such an important skill. So what tips would you give for someone like me?
For sure. So I would say first and foremost, make it simple, right? Even though making my pictures black and white, that was a very strategic move in that doing that is as simple as taking a picture, putting it into an app and just putting a black and white filter on it. It can immediately make it pretty and it takes seconds, right? Mm-hmm. That's the same approach I've taken with my site where people comment all the time, like, dude, your site is is super, super simple, but it's so easy to read and it's beautiful. And there's not a lot that has gone into that site. There hasn't been a lot of programming. It's not like things are moving around. It's just a super simple scrolling site with tons of white space. So I would tell you, if you're not a designer, don't get fancy. Just keep it simple and keep it pretty. And it allows people to also kind of focus on the content that you're putting out, whether that's a podcast or videos or the written word.
That's super helpful. Thank you. So continue on the Instagram theme. I noticed when reading one of your recent posts that you took a break from Instagram. And I'm curious why you decided to take a break and what you learned from an Instagram hiatus.
Absolutely. So earlier this year, and I'll have to rewind a hair to give like some background here, but I suppose at the beginning of last year, I met a girl on Instagram who lived in Colorado, and we actually had grown up together when we were 13, 14, 15 years old in Southern Indiana. She moved away, a decade passed. And so I use the word meet pretty intentional there because I feel like we're different people over the course of 10 years. So anyways, we get reconnected on Instagram. And she really follows my work, and we sort of become pen pals in a way. And I really end up falling for her, and she kind of does the same with me. And one thing led to another, and one day it was like a Friday morning, and I just realized, okay, I really kind of want to take this girl out to coffee. The issue was I was living in Nashville, Tennessee at the time, and she was living in Denver. And so I just wrote her and said, hey, what are you doing Sunday morning? And she was like, I don't know. I think I'm getting my hair done. Why? And I go, well, I'd love to fly in and take you to coffee. And she said she like threw her phone and freaked the fuck out because obviously that's like crazy, right? But fortunately, like she worked up the courage to say, yeah, I'd love for you to do that. And so I flew in, and anyways, long story longer, it turned into this beautiful year-long relationship that heavily impacted my work and myself, and I hope really positively impacted her. And being that it was long distance, a lot of our communication when we weren't seeing each other and spending time together was done via text or on Instagram. And so earlier, sort of in the middle of the pandemic, that relationship ended. And so being on Instagram was a super, super painful process where, you know, you'd be checking your inbox and her name wasn't there and everything on there reminded you of her. So I had to really remove myself from it because I felt like this platform where I had been able to express myself and that had given me so much, like this beautiful relationship with someone, was now this source of terrible, terrible unhappiness. So I deleted the app and took a break for, you know, 2 or 3 months. And now I feel like I have a healthier relationship with it again. But I think that's important with anything in life that can be addicting or maybe we feel like can control us too much, is giving ourselves that space when we feel like we're becoming too consumed by it.
Dude, I really appreciate you sharing the story. And it goes back to the honesty we were talking about before in this conversation, is like, you are just incredibly honest. And just like you're writing, it's like you are bringing just your 100% truth to the table. What would you say to someone who's having trouble bringing that truth to any conversation or their own writing?
I would say that I think it's what we have to. So I'm a big believer in leave the world better than you found it, and we can do that in so many different ways. Like you're doing it right now by having these great conversations with people throughout the world, and bringing these new ideas and these experiences and these stories to your audience, right? For me as a writer, it is, I've experienced extreme amounts of loneliness, right? And so has everybody else. And as a writer, by being super, super authentic, it kind of creates these aha moments for people where they're like, fuck, I'm not the only one in the world that experiences that emotion. I'm not the only one in the world that gets to that super dark place or has that super fucked up thought. And so what I would tell people who are truly writers and are truly pursuing the craft and truly want to have an impact on other people's lives is that you should be honest, because it's the most selfless act that you can do, because it allows other people to connect with your story in an honest way, right? By telling that story I just did, even though it's like a little bit painful, right? I've told enough times that it's not like I'm tearing open a wound or anything, but by telling the story of like, yeah, I had to get off Instagram because I couldn't stop thinking about this girl I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life with, there might be someone listening who's like, I've experienced that exact same thing. So I would just say, if you're not willing to be honest for yourself, be honest for other people, because it I think in a lot of ways can be that source of comfort for them.
Hmm. You mentioned before if you're truly a writer. I'm curious, what makes a true writer to you, Cole?
It's approaching it like a pro, right? That Stephen Pressfield kind of idea. I love the ukulele. I like strumming the ukulele. I might pick it up once a week or every couple of weeks, and I can play a few tunes on it, right? But I'm not a professional ukuleleist. One, because I'm not looking to try to make a living with it, right? I'm also not approaching it with this level of seriousness, like I want to become the best I can be. And so I think what makes a rider is when you move from saying you're a hobbyist, right? And you're saying, I'm burning my ships at the shore and I'm going all in on this riding thing. And it doesn't mean that you ever have to make it, right? You might say, I have worked a 40-year career as a pipe fitter, but every single night I have at 5 o'clock, I have a date with myself for an hour where I'm working on my short stories. And it doesn't mean you ever have to get rich. It doesn't mean you ever have to make loads amount of money, but I think it's just a shift in mindset. And so that to me is what makes a rider.
Well, you're certainly a pro. And one question I have for you is, what's it like to have 150,000 people appreciate the work of yours, but think of it as the work of someone else? Take me through that story and what that must have felt like when you wrote something, you publish it on Medium under the name of someone else, and it gets all this accolade and all this praise, but you're sitting there thinking, I wrote that. That was my idea. That was my thinking. Talk to me through that.
Yes. Yeah, that's a story deep in the archives. So, and to give a little bit of context here, early on in my career, I worked as a ghostwriter for some prominent entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who clearly weren't writers at all, but they hired me, or I worked. I also worked with an agency that connected me with them, where I would actually write the stories. They'd stamp their name on it, and then it was their work. Right? This happens all the time. Anytime you see an A-list celebrity put out a book, 9 out of 10 times they're not writing it themselves. There's some ghostwriter, and it might be a super prominent ghostwriter. You know, that it might be a super prominent writer who is just doing ghostwriting. They might get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to write some book, like Neil Strauss, who wrote The Game and some of these other books. He's a prolific writer, really, really talented. He's done a lot of ghostwriting for A-list celebrities. but early on in my career, I did some ghostwriting for this one entrepreneur, and I wrote a piece that blew up. I mean, it was all over the web and people were praising it, and they weren't praising me, they were praising this entrepreneur. And it was this really weird feeling where thus far it is the most successful piece I've ever created. Wow. But my name's not in it. It's not on it, right? No one knows that I put that piece out. And I didn't sign anything to say I can't announce now that it's my piece, but it's more of like a moral thing of like, hey, he paid me really good money to write this piece, and it's his piece, right? It's like if you were to craft some beautiful wood table and then sell it to someone else, right? It's now their piece. It's now theirs. And at that point on, I just said, you know what? Maybe I'm leaving some money on the table, but I'm going to own every piece of work that I write, even if it's for a brand, even if I'm doing work for Bowflex or Onnit or some of these other cool brands that I work with. I don't ever want to find myself in a situation where I can't proudly point to that piece and say, hey, that was me. You know, I wrote that. I had something to do with that. So it's a shitty feeling, but it was a beautiful lesson because it sort of goes back to that honesty that we talked about. And that was a place where it would have been really, really nice to be super honest and say, hey, this is my work. I just couldn't do it though, you know.
Do you ever go back to that piece and look at it and be like, oh man, I wish I put my name on this? Or did it not reflect you fully? Like, or talk to me about that.
No, I mean, I just don't read it. I try to avoid it.
Kind of like that girl on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, I just stay off Medium.
Well, sorry for bringing it up then if it's a sore subject.
Oh, it's all good, man. It's all good.
So also in doing research for this conversation, I found that it was very important for you to remain a one-person shop. That's something you've said in the past. So my question is, why was that important for you?
Yeah, so this is the classic sort of Seth Godin idea of the freelancer versus entrepreneur, right? There's a lot of times people get them confused. A freelancer is someone who gets paid to show up and create magic for a brand or for a person, right? And then an entrepreneur is someone that's building something that can run without them being, without them steering the ship, really, right? So Nike, once Phil Knight dies, Nike is still going to exist, right? But for some of these others, for much, much smaller entrepreneurs, like let's say, and I can't even call them entrepreneurs, I almost have to call them like small business owners, which essentially could be freelancers. So right now here in Nashville, one of my favorite places to eat is this tiny hole in the wall shop called Thai Kitchen. And they make the best curry in the world, right? And it's done by this tiny woman who might be in her 70s, right? And she can barely speak any English, but she is just fucking magic at cooking, like just mad skills. Once she moves on from this earth, Thai Kitchen will be no more. Someone else could buy it, but it's never ever going to be the same. And I think that there's so much beauty in that like you can create this thing that's only going to be around for a little while. It's like a pop-up shop in a lot of ways where, hey, it's going to be around for as long as I'm breathing. But once I've moved on, that shit's gone, right? You can't experience it anymore. And so there's magic in that, where that has always resonated with me, where I want to be this one man shop, and Honey Copy is going to exist as long as I'm here on earth. But after that, and after I move on, it's just not going to be here anymore. So there's that. The other side of things that like is really important is, let's say you are a denim maker, you make jeans, right? When you decide to become an entrepreneur and hire a bunch of other denim makers to build this like jean making brand, now all of a sudden you're no longer making jeans, right? What you're actually doing is managing a bunch of other people making jeans. And so that was something I found in writing. I got to this point a year or two ago where Honey Copy had grown, and it was like growing at a crazy pace. And I realized, shit, I could hire 2 to 3 full-time writers and pay them. But what does that look like? And what it would have looked like is, now I become the guy constantly pitching business, not doing any of the writing, which is what I love, and managing and editing all of these other writers. And that's just not the shit I signed up for. And so what I did instead was I raised my prices 2 to 3 times, turned a lot more people away. And now I'm still making really good money with Honey Copy, but it's just me and only me. And I get to wake up every day and do what I love, which is write my own stuff, or write for other brands, or have conversations like these where I'm talking about the writing process.
That's beautiful. And was that something, did you ever envision one day having a big shop, or like, did this vision come up about organically, or did you change your mind on this at all as you progressed in your career?
It's been something I've learned more as I've done the hands in the dirt work of building Honey Copy. Right, where there's been moments where I thought, man, it'd be really cool to be like a David Ogilvy and build this huge agency that has all this clout and works with these massive brands and is doing these multi-million dollar brand deals and stuff, right? That'd be awesome. But I just found that once I got a taste of what that reality looked like. So, I mean, I took on a few projects where I was managing some other freelancers and acting more as like the project manager. I just realized like that's not all what it's made out to be. And so, yeah, I've had moments where I've wanted that, but I just try to remember that the reality isn't always quite as extravagant as what the dream is for that stuff.
Going back real quick to your early days as a writer and your childhood, I want to ask if you've always considered yourself a writer, or that's something that's developed after you were in that ad agency or were in college or writing poetry. When did that idea and identity of you as a writer form?
I wish I could say that it formed when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, like I was some prodigy. I don't think it did. I think there was a seed in me, you know, that was planted there by the universe or God or whatever, you know, that I could potentially one day be a writer. But I didn't know it until I was in my 20s. And one day I just woke up and it was like I started writing and just couldn't stop, and I haven't been able to stop since. One interesting story from my childhood, though, was when I was in the third grade, I had this splendid teacher named Miss Woodall, and she was really like the first person in my life who – that's not fair, not the first person, because my parents have always been super supportive, but the first teacher that didn't make me feel stupid, because I was always a very hyper kid and had a pretty crazy imagination and was daydreaming, and I could never pay attention. And she was sort of the first teacher that stepped into my life and did this magical thing that where she said, you know, you're not in these exact words, but made me realize like I'm more powerful than I think I am. And I remember doing I was obsessed with drawing weird fish at the time. Like I would draw these crocodiles like sharks. And so I created this like story about these crocodile sharks fighting these piranhas, and I drew pictures of them and wrote like a story about this war between these two mythical fish, because the piranhas were like aliens. They're like a mixture of like a piranha and also those angler fish with the large like what are they called? You know what I'm talking about? The angler fish that have that light that stems from their head and it brings prey close to their mouths, and then they'll reach out and bite them and eat the fish. I like created some alien type fish like that. And most teachers would be like, what are you doing? You know, focus on spelling right, or focus on math, or focus on this subject we're teaching. And instead she takes this story and gets it bound and turns it into this book for me, right? This picture book. And so I wish I could say at that moment, I was like, oh, I want to be a writer I want to be a writer. But I think it just more so planted the seed in my head. And it also, you know, she made me feel really, really special when she did that. So that's something I've always remembered. But no, I didn't realize that I had – that I could make it in this game until I was in my early 20s.
That's an awesome story. And before we wrap this up, I like to ask guests – if they have any final pieces of parting wisdom for someone trying to improve, whether that be physically, mentally, spiritually, as a writer, whatever it may be, final pieces of parting wisdom for that person. Cole Schaefer, take it away, brother.
That's a huge responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big responsibility.
I think you're up to
having that mic drop moment. Okay, yeah, I have a good one. So I think it is super, super important to suck at something new every once in a while. Most of the time we go through our lives where we start working this career and we get a year into this career and we're by no means seasoned veterans, but we know what we're doing and there's not necessarily a whole lot of challenges left there. With writing, like that's an example where I'm 4 or 5 years into it and I'm nowhere near the writer I want to be. And I constantly have to challenge myself and read new books and work on new techniques and try new stories, whether it's like moving from poetry into short stories and stuff like that. But I will say that when I'm on the page, I'm extremely comfortable being on the page and I'm extremely comfortable writing. Something that came to my attention recently, and it's been this strange shift in my life, is as I've garnered a larger audience with my writing, I'm getting asked to do these things that I never thought I would do. And that's give poetry readings, do team workshops, do podcasts like this, even though this was brought about by an introduction rather than, you know, you requesting. Like, I want to be transparent there. Like, but, I'm finding myself in these opportunities where I have to speak, and man, like the best metaphor I can use with speaking and writing is that when I'm writing, I feel like a swan that's just floating and gliding across a lake. But when I have to turn around and speak and make noise with my mouth, I feel like an awkward swan fumbling like on the grass. Right? I just feel like an idiot. I don't feel super comfortable with it. And for the longest time, I tried to avoid that. And so recently, I've been working with a speaking coach on just trying to cut a lot of the fat and the fluff out of my speech and get better at telling stories and get better at sort of what Seth Godin does, where he always has something to reach for the moment you, like you could say tennis ball and he'll immediately be able to tell you a story of a tennis ball. I want to become that kind of speaker. But with that, I've had to be okay with really sucking at doing this type of thing and do uncomfortable stuff like this, where there's been multiple times I've been talking with you during this episode where I'm like, fuck, that line was really dumb, or that didn't work out so well, or I wish I would have said that a little bit better. I've been having that sort of internal dialogue. But I think by allowing yourself to suck at new things, one, it humbles you to realize like, hey, you're not hot shit. You might be hot shit in writing, but you're not hot shit in speaking, or you're not great in these other aspects of life. But two, I think as long as we are doing something new, it informs our vocation, right? So as I've been working with a speaking coach and have really tried to cut back on the fat that I've been using like in my verbal language, I've had to take a closer look at my writing too. And I'm realizing, hey, this writing can get pretty fatty and fluffy in places. Maybe I can start cutting back some there too. So yeah, I would just say do something, whether it's once a quarter, once a year, whatever that looks like, where you're learning something new and you're sucking at it, because I think it always informs our vocation. And we might not see it right off the bat, but it eventually will.
Dude, first of all, thank you for sharing the story. Like, you've been so forthright and honest during this conversation. Two, that surprises the hell out of me because you've done an incredible job. I've done now 55 of these episodes and I would never know that you had issues speaking or thought you could be better. You did an incredible job. So
thanks, man.
Thank you for taking the time, Cole. I truly, truly appreciate it. And where can people find you on the internet?
For sure. Just honeycopy.com. That's honeycopy.com. And my site's super simple to navigate. So they'll be able to find what email list they want to join. And then I'm on Instagram just at Cole_Schaefer. And those are the two main places I hang out.
Awesome. And you guys should definitely check out that website because there's so much gold on there. Thank you, Cole, again for taking the time. And I look forward to staying in contact with you, man. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, man. Keep doing this, dude. This was a lot of fun. And I have been digging back through your other podcast episodes, the one you did with Harry and some of these other people that I follow online. And it's cool seeing you grow in the craft too. So keep it up.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Cole Schaefer. If you enjoyed this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda is the best place to give me feedback for this episode. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.